Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
My guest tonight is a Golden Globe and three-time Emmy Award winner. She's one of the funniest people in show business, one of the sweetest people I've been fortunate enough to get to know. She's incredible with improv. And we all witnessed that with Christopher Guest in films like Best in Show, Mighty Wind, For Your Consideration. But it was the slushy-slamming high school cheerleader coach, Sue Sylvester, that brought her into our living rooms every week on Glee. And also, thanks to her show Hollywood Game Night, which I've done, and it's so much fun, she's the only person in town who can blow popcorn into a celebrity's face for getting an answer wrong without someone calling TMZ. It's a delightful experience. I hope you all get to have the popcorn experience at some point. But tonight, Jane Lynch will be talking with Chris Hardwick. Very good. Very good. Got a room full of Jane Lynch fans here. We've all heard from you on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook using @talking. I'm going to read questions, comments, comments. Use the hashtag #TalkingHardwick if you feel like it, or don't. I'm not the boss of you. But we're going to get some video messages in here for Jane. Plus, you guys are all going to have a chance to ask some questions I'm going to give you. I have a crate full of Jane Lynch-related prizes here for you. But first, it has been so delightful to get to know you.
Back at you.
I mean, seriously, because we've always, you know, I think our friend circles were sort of close-ish to each other. Mm-hmm. And then I did Hollywood Game Night, which was incredible.
You were great.
Thank you so much. I was really nervous.
You did great. And I just have to tell you about the blowing the popcorn in the face game. We always have a regular person who's not a celebrity, and he knew that she got the answer wrong, and he knew that she was going to get popcorn in her face, and he dove in and took it for her.
I did.
When I fell in love with her.
I did a slow-mo dive in.
You did a slow-mo dive.
It was so much fun. And then Jane and I ran into each other at one of these really long, when you work for shows, you have to do these long press days.
Yes.
Where you just go through and you talk to a million people and you answer the same five questions. And it's always fun to see people that you know there.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you got to do this too.
Right.
And I ran into you there. And that night I sent you a direct message on Twitter. I said, here's my phone number. Here's my email. I need to be friends with you. I hope that's not creepy.
It was fantastic.
Good.
And I returned it immediately.
And
look,
so,
here we are.
And here we are. So
yes.
Thank you for being here. Were you in Second City, or did you tour with Second City?
I toured with Second City. I wasn't on stage, but I toured with Second City like in 1987 through 1988, I think.
And where were you guys touring, and what were you touring?
Mainly St. Louis. I felt like we went to St. Louis 100 times. We were all over the country in a van.
Right.
There were, I'm trying to think if you would know, Stephen Colbert was there
of course.
At the time, Stephen Carell.
I've heard of them.
Yeah, indeed.
Yes.
Tim Meadows was actually in my cast. It was five men and two girls, and we just drove the van all over the country, and we would do the sketch comedy, the best of Second City. We
didn't
improvise very much. We would do the sketches that really worked on stage, and we would do like an hour and a half show, and you know, it was life on the road. It was really fun. I was young, and you know, you didn't care that you were staying in the worst hotels with a roommate.
Right.
You know, but it was
fun. And so were you performing at colleges or corporate
events? Yeah, all those things where you have to incorporate like the CEO's name into your joke, that kind of thing.
They tell you which guy to make fun. You got to make fun of Irv in accounting. That guy is a hoot. And
exactly.
Then it turns out Irv is not a hoot at all.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we had a lot of that, but it was a lot of corporate events, a lot of colleges, and then like little theater. We played in some really great, like, historic theaters in tiny towns, you know? It was really great.
And so was your career plan, like, I'm just... I'm going to go into comedy or I want to be a performer? What did you want to do?
I wanted to be a performer. I wanted to, I always wanted to be an actor, but I was always funny, so I would get the funny part. But I went to school for acting. I went to a professional training program at Cornell where we learned to fence and do ballet, and we did Chekhov, and we had method acting classes. We had voice lessons and that sort of thing, and I thought I would be, a repertory actor.
Right.
Somebody who ends up at the Guthrie or something, and you just do play after play. And then, all great plans, that you make for yourself. And then what really happens is always different. I got an audition for the Second City touring company, and that's what started the whole sketch thing for me.
Sure. And was improv any part of the program? Or
you had to improvise in order to audition. And the bulk of the improvisation takes place with the cast that's doing the residents, that are in Chicago. So,
yeah.
And then they improvise to create the show. And then the show basically stays the same from there. And they'll do an improv set at the end. And I did some, I was Bonnie Hunt's understudy.
Oh, wow.
So I got to go out for her a lot of the time. And then you would do improv at the end of the night. And that was my least favorite part. That's the part that scared me the most.
But you're so good at it, though.
Oh, there's different. Second City, you say, give me a first line of dialogue,
sure.
That type of thing. With the Christopher Guest movies, you're not running to the joke. You're kind of creating the situation. It can take as long as you want because he gets in there and he edits it.
Right.
So there's no pressure to be funny.
Right.
It's just tell the story.
Yeah.
So it's a different thing than, what can I say that's funny that'll get
the audience? Well, yeah, because I think I think sometimes when people think of improv that way, they think of I'm going to go on a Saturday night and see a comedy improv show that's very joke-based.
Yeah.
But there is... but the other side of improv is long form story building, team exercises, and you're really together finding how these characters relate to one another.
Now, do you do heralds?
No, I tried it early on, and I always wanted to be a stand up.
Oh right,
and
that's
the stand up gene kind of crushes the improv gene because stand up is all about you, and improv and sketch is all about the group.
Yeah, it's a team sport.
Yeah,
indeed.
So I think people can cross over very easily from improv and sketch to stand-up, but I think it's difficult to do it the other way.
Yeah, it is. What's interesting, on Hollywood Game Night, we've had a few stand-ups. You are excluded from this broad generalization I'm about to make.
All right.
The guys and gals who are stand-ups weren't as much of a team player, and were kind of out of their element.
Sure.
They were kind of, there were a couple of them were really uncomfortable.
Yeah, because when you're doing stand-up, it's just you and the audience, and you're in control of everything.
Yes.
And so when you put stand-ups in a situation where they have to improvise with someone else, you will find that the stand-up gene makes them go for the joke over the scene.
Yes.
And then take control.
Exactly.
And go, I'm this person, you're a baby delivery nurse, you're a vet. And everyone's like, whoa, hey, we're supposed to choose those things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And what I love about stand-up, and it's the reason I don't do it, a lot of people think I am a comedian. I'm not. I just host things. And what I love about what you guys do is how precise the precision. Now, I understand that. I get that. You map out the whole set. And you know where you're going to hit the joke, and you know how to throw the joke away, and you get it. It gets in your body almost like a dance.
It does, but I'm always so impressed by really good improv and really good sketch because you really understand how to work together, and you really understand, especially with improv, how to be flexible.
Yeah.
And I think flexibility is the most important tool set for a performer.
Absolutely.
And you must have learned, especially because even though you're doing sketches on the road, every show is different, and I'm sure you're in a lot of shitty venues with people who aren't paying attention.
And we're having fun with each other.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. The flexibility is a big deal. One of the things I learned right away is you cannot have a preconceived idea about how you're going to do a scene. You really, it doesn't happen until you're acting with the other person, and it happens completely differently every night. You might have the same lines in the same movement, but it's a completely different animal every night. And I love that. And you can't stand firm in your, I do it this way. You have to really allow yourself to open up. And then you're, of course, I remember when I first started at Second City, the guys, Jeff Michalski was our director, and he said, be ready to fail 85% of the time.
Yeah. And as long as you know that that's can happen, and then it does, and then you go, oh, okay, that's
But even failure's great. That's why people come to improv shows, to see everybody, kind of goof up and pick up the pieces and make something out of it. I think that's the fun thing about it.
I agree, because you are essentially, when an audience comes to a show, no matter what type of performance it is, I feel like they are asking to be taken on a journey. They are putting their faith in whoever is on stage, whether it's a group or a person, that that person can lead them in some place. So if you fuck up and... But if you're like, oh, my God, I'm so sorry, then the audience immediately loses faith. Right. And they go, okay, this person couldn't handle it.
Right, right.
But if you don't, if you roll with it and you're cool with it and you turn it into a joke, then it's a nice part of an experience that you all shared
together. I think that's the important part about, and this goes for acting in plays and anything live, is confidence is the most important thing. I think you can stink the joint up and maybe have the worst jokes in the world. But if you're confident and you're standing up there kind of, you know, you know when you fail, quote unquote, there really is no failure. But the audience can then relax.
Yeah.
And like you said, take you on this journey. So confidence means so much. And when somebody's up there and they're new and they're kind of second guessing themselves and or they're trying to run in with just a joke, you know, like sometimes people do, they'll take over a scene and just to get their joke in. The audience can feel that and they lose trust in you.
Sure. Now, I view you as a very confident person because I know how amazing you are as a performer. But you have perfect posture. Your posture, you have a perfect spinal. I mean, it's perfect. It's even watching the like segments of the Vogue, Madonna, and I'm like, she's got perfect posture.
It is, but I needed to learn how to like loose. I was watching the Vogue thing backstage, and I mean, I looked kind of like a statue, you know.
I think it made me go, oh yeah, Madonna. What Madonna does is not that. Like Jane Lynch could be Madonna. Like, you could absolutely be Madonna.
Yeah.
But were you always was confidence something that you was just innately part of your personality? Were you always comfortable with who you were? Did you always know?
You know what? I was always more comfortable on stage than I was with myself off stage. And now I think they match. Because you kind of don't. I don't worry about things like I used to when I was younger. But I definitely. When I was younger, I didn't have confidence in myself socially or the ability to get a job. But once I got it, I knew I'd be fine.
Who was your group in high school? Like, what was your clique?
Well, I had this guy, Chris. He was gay, and I was gay, and we never told each other. And Chris.
Chris, yeah.
Jane and Chris. And people would
good
say,
to see
Jane
you again.
Yeah, good to see you
again,
my friend.
Yeah, thank you.
People would say, Jane is great, Chris is great, Jane and Chris are trouble. we were trouble, and we would smoke, and we would get high, and we loved choir. I didn't like getting high that much. It was mostly drinking. Actually.
There have been so many amazing points about how to be comfortable with yourself and how to do improv
and relate to other people. I listen
to
you.
We used to get high.
And yet we'd go to choir.
Yeah.
We'd cut all of our classes, but we'd show up at choir.
Uh-huh.
We'd show up for play practice. So we were kind. He was kind of more on the outs than I was in terms of, like, the social hierarchy. I was, I kind of floated.
Gotcha.
You know, I stayed under the radar, and I had friends who were cheerleaders. I had some friends who were basketball players. But he was my closest.
And so you said you were both gay but didn't know it.
Well,
we knew it.
Certainly weren't talking about it.
You didn't talk about it. Where did you grow up?
The south side of Chicago in a suburb.
Gotcha. Oh, hey. Hey, drugs in Chi-Town, you guys.
Yeah.
That's what fuels this crowd.
Cornridge High School, yeah.
Yeah, thick pizza and weed.
Yeah.
That's what people are into. I mean, at that time, was that just not something people were talking about?
No, it was a completely different time. Nobody talked about it. I never heard the word.
I mean,
I knew there was something going on with me that wasn't right.
Well,
I had a disease.
Who do you talk to at that point?
I didn't. Nobody. Yeah. Talked to nobody. And he would like sneak off and go to Chicago on the weekends and he'd go to bars and stuff. And I had no idea.
So at what point did you realize, oh, okay, this is who I am and that's okay?
A theater. When I got into theater, it's teeming with gay people.
Sure.
Absolutely. You know? True. Yeah. You know, when you're hanging out in like arty circles, you run into that. You know, people are who they are, and there's much less judgment. I was going to say no judgment. There was some, but you know, it was a much easier line of work to be a gay person in. And believe me, I wasn't walking around with a rainbow flag.
Sure.
I still had some, you know, kind of self-hating homophobia. Still living inside of me, but eventually that went away. And the big when I told my parents, I didn't tell my parents till I was about 32. And once I told my parents, it was just, you know, once I knew they were okay with me, I didn't. The world was.
And they were cool.
But if I had come out when I was 18, it would have been a different story. I think it would have been much harder.
I mean, I one of the reasons why I think it's really important to hear stories like that or talk about it is because I just think you achieving what you've achieved. And being as beloved as you are, to hear you talk about it in just very normal terms is just, it normalizes and it just makes it feel like, yeah, it's okay, it's fine. Don't beat yourself up about it. Just learn to accept who you are.
Yeah, and it's really tough for kids. And, you know, we're in a crazy political climate right now, too. But I know it's tough for kids who don't live in New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Or near a big city. It's still really, really, can be really tough. They could be taking their lives in their own, you know, in their hands to be open and out about that. So, you know, I just always say, move to a big city, get an improv comedy. We'll love you.
Well, what is it? You know, what advice do you have for young people who are trying to figure out their identity and maybe don't feel as accepted in their own immediate circles? Like, what can they do, or what
I think
would you say to them?
I, you know, I think it's tough. I think if you're in a town or, you know, part of the country that doesn't accept it, you do have to be quiet because you can be dangerous.
Right.
But, you know, just know that there's a lot of love in the world, and just get yourself to a big city.
Yeah.
And that it'll change eventually. It'll all change. It'll be normalized.
Yeah, I think it's important to, if you feel like you're, you know, hey, I don't feel comfortable conforming to this community that I'm in.
Yeah.
Go to a different community.
That's exactly what I did, too. And thank God I wanted to be an actress because, you know, if I had stayed where I was, it would have been, I think, a rough. I think I'd be a lot fatter than I am. Fatter. Probably be an active alcoholic.
just trying to mush it
down. Right, mush it all down. Exactly.
Talking, getting mad at everyone every time someone mentions New York pizza. Yeah, that pizza's the worst. What are you talking about? People care more about pizza than most social issues.
Yeah.
That if you go to Chicago and say New York pizza, someone will kick the shit out of you.
Well, here's the thing. You're incorrect in saying that the thick pizza is the Chicago pizza. That's Chicago tourist pizza.
Oh, gotcha.
I'm from the south side of Chicago, and there's a restaurant called Aurelio's, and it has the best pizza, and they now have a store in Chicago proper. But it's very thin crust, and the tomato sauce is almost sweet, and it's crispy and sweet, and then you got the spicy sausage. It's amazing.
Sounds a little like New York pizza to me. I'm not going to say anything.
I haven't had good pizza in New York, though.
You haven't?
No, I haven't. Where should I go?
What about Ray's on every corner?
It's not good.
No, you don't like it?
No, I don't like it at all. There's nothing to write home about. I'm sorry.
Dear Mom and Dad, I have a pizza tale for you?
Yeah, the most mediocre pizza I ever...
Why would you even waste the stamp on this?
And who writes letters?
Letters about pizza. Who writes letters, period, anymore?
I know, really.
I mean, in our ever-changing landscape of depersonalization where it's more and more and more digital.
Yes.
So Christopher Guest, how did you guys hook up?
I was doing a lot of commercials in the year 1999.
In the 1900s.
It was the year of Jane Lynch in 1999, commercial-wise, the last century. I did like 7 or 8 national commercials, and one of them was directed by Christopher Guest, and I didn't know until I showed up for the callback, and I had seen Waiting for Guffman, and I was in love with Waiting for Guffman, which was his actually second film like this. The first was Spinal Tap, but this was the first one he directed. And so I did this Kellogg's Frosted Flakes commercial with him, and then at lunch he said, you know, I do movies, and I was like, yeah, I know. And, and he said, I'd love to work with you again, and I said, oh, wow, that would be great. And within about 6 months, I ran into him at a restaurant, and he cast me in Best in Show.
Did you say that was great, or you say, that's great?
That's great!
I mean, I remember auditioning for him for a commercial probably like 2000 or 2001 something, and I was a mess at that time. I was still drinking, and I was smoking, and I auditioned for him, and he was really nice, and I was outside smoking, and he came out, and he goes, I'd never met him before, and he goes, what are you doing? And I go, what do you mean? He goes, you're smoking. You're a young guy. What are you doing? Why are you doing this to yourself? And I go, I'm cool. And then an ash from the cigarette like floated up in the air and landed on his sweater. And he's very meticulous. He seems very meticulous.
Yes.
And I just immediately saw him go like that. And I was like, well, I'm not booking this job.
Right.
I just ashed on Christopher Guest.
Right.
And then I just assumed that he would forget my face and name altogether. But he seems like such an interesting force.
Force is the word, too. You know, he doesn't suffer fools, and he doesn't care if you're uncomfortable. he's also, he's like an amazingly supportive guy. You know, he rarely will laugh out loud, but if you can get him to laugh out loud or at least go, you know it was a pretty good joke.
Yeah, I had done that until I put cigarette ash on him, and then he was not laughing so hard anymore. So what is what does a day look like when you show up, you know, on any of Best in Show or Mighty Wind? Do you have some idea of what you're supposed to accomplish that day?
Yes, we do. We don't have a script, but we have a scenario. So it'll be like exterior in front of the dog show in the parking lot. So-and-so and such talk about how nervous they are, you know, and how they lost last year and how they're hoping to place this year. And then you've got that information that's important. And then you can go from there wherever you want to go. And there's no rehearsal. You do all your prep ahead of time. And again, it's not one of those things that you can really plan. You kind of ruin it if you plan. Like, I had some stories that I was going to tell as my character, and that was a good way to get into the character. Was I would sit in the mirror and tell stories and talk to myself in the mirror. But, you know, when you're facing Jennifer Coolidge and she's giving you some, you just have to be there in the moment.
Right.
You have to really know who your person is, and you have to just be there in the moment. And the scenes can go on forever, the shooting of the scenes. But then he gets in there, and I remember I was out of gas completely. I had nothing else to say, and you hear the camera going, right? Better come up with something else. So,
and so Jen Coolidge, because by the way, the assembly of performers that he works with are all like comedy stars.
Yeah.
And a lot of them, you know, were people that you had seen around and go, I know that face. And but he really pulled this group of talent together, and then they all blossomed in the way that they were. But Jennifer Coolidge, I think, was a groundling.
She was a groundling, absolutely.
But like a legendary groundling.
Yeah.
And fun.
Huge choices.
Huge choices. Fun in a crazy way.
Yeah.
And so do you have any good Jen Coolidge stories?
Well, she and I went to Stanley. We were in Vancouver.
Yeah.
So we would walk to Stanley Park every day because we didn't work every day. We would work like, we were in Vancouver for like a month, and we would work 2 or 3 days a week. And we talked a lot about our characters together, which is not any, I wouldn't do that with the other films. We didn't, just because we didn't have time, but we had all this time, so we would have a lot of fun. But she was watching porno every night. For some reason, she got it for free. And she said, I can't take my eyes off. So when we were in Stanley Park, she would act some scenes out for me. She'd get on a park bench, and she'd grab a hold of it, and then he did this while she did that. And so it was a lot of fun. And then we went hiking once. We went through, you know, like the interior of the park, and we got lost. And we were starving. We hadn't eaten anything. And we couldn't find our way out of the park. And finally, we ran into some people. We were, like, deep in the woods. We ran into some people, and I said, how do you get out of here? And they said, oh, you have to go this way, that way. And they were eating raisins and carrots. And I said, can I have a carrot? And they said, yes. And then Jen stuck her head around and was like, can my friend have a carrot? They fed us so we didn't pass out.
So you're basically just like rabbits in the forest feeding us.
I'm so hungry.
Whatever you can get a hold of.
And then she would lose her wallet daily. Daily. And I would, because she's one of these like brilliant spacey people. So we would get back to the hotel and she'd call and say, you don't have my wallet, do you? Don't worry about it. And I'd go back out in the rain. I like would go to every restaurant or store we had been to, and I'd find her wallet for her.
Well, that's it. You know, it's interesting that you say that because I think there is the kind of mythos of the genius performer who's so, like, when they're on, it's like the most incredible thing that you've seen. But in life, they just, you know, if their head wasn't screwed on.
Exactly. She's one of those. She does this a lot. So always trying to put pieces together.
So how are you so together and still have all of the comedy superpowers?
Oh, well, thank you for saying that. But, you know, when people ask you if you couldn't act, what would you do?
Right.
I'd be an assistant for sure. I love details. I love taking care of. I'd be a great wife. I like taking, you know, in the traditional sense.
Sure.
I love taking care of things. I don't like to cook. But I like details. I like keeping, and I get such satisfaction out of that.
And you feel like that aids in for you as a performer?
I think so. I think, you know what I do? Even though you want to be, you know, flexible, as I was saying earlier, you were saying, and I echoed, I still kind of map stuff out. I map it out pretty well. Even if I'm improvising, I map out my character really well. I don't know what's going to happen within the scene, but I'm uber, uber prepared.
Yeah.
And I work things to death. And I love it. I love it. That's my favorite thing in the world to do, is to like really like work the inflection of a joke and come up with a new joke. And, you know, that's my favorite thing.
So you're touring with Second City in like 87 for a couple of years, and then you said 99 is when you started the year of Jane Lynch where you started doing commercials. So
I did say that, didn't I?
How? I mean, America collectively said it.
That's true. I'm just echoing
them. Tony the Tiger said it too.
Right.
But this whole time, you know, what's going on? When do you feel like your career really started to pop? When do you sort of feel like, aha, I think this is the thing that I was always striving for?
I guess I loved it the whole time. You know, I really did love it the whole time. I would, like, if it all went away today, I would do a production of Gypsy in Palmdale. I just would.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably Best in Show, though, is when people started to know my name. But before that, I was guest starring on... oh, my God, you see my IMDb page.
I have a bunch of TV credits here.
I did a bunch of guest spots on so many things, like 2-3 lines.
Here we go. Sometimes
I get a couple of scenes.
Do you want this list here?
Sure.
Just to take you down. Married with Children, Party of Five, News Radio, Sybil, Third Rock from the Sun, Dharma and Greg, Gilmore Girls, Dawson's Creek, West Wing, X-Files, Felicity, Seventh Heaven, Arrested Development, Friends, Veronica Mars, CSI, Weeds, Desperate Housewives, New Adventures of Old Christine, 2½ Men, My Name is Earl, Psych. Those are just the TV credits. I mean...
I used to like to audition, not anymore, but I despise it now.
How did you like... and then I want to hear about your worst commercial audition, because commercial auditions are the soul-sucking.
Yeah, they are, aren't they?
Yeah.
I'll just tell you, I don't have a specific instance, but it's when they don't even look up.
Right.
When you walk into the room and they're like, these depressed people, they take the camera, make sure you're in it, and say, go. Oh, it's the worst, and there's 20 billion people waiting to get in. Yeah, those are the worst.
Yeah, and there's just like, and they always, you know, there are these like audition centers.
Yes.
Where it's like one studio is all like guys auditioning for a deodorant, and then, you know, a bunch of kids running around with where you can see the frazzled stage moms who are like,
exactly.
I never got my shot! You know? It's just like the sad, like everything about it's such a bummer.
Yeah.
I think that is almost a, if you can survive it.
Yeah.
Then it really gives you strength and some tool sets.
It can, or it can turn you into a monster, too.
It can.
Because some people, I think, act like assholes just because they were treated so badly way back when. But I think probably for both of us, it gave us a humility. We're like, now when people get us... Look, I have 2 drinks here.
You do. Yeah, one, you got some black tea there.
Yeah,
you got,
I got
some water.
Coffee.
You got some coffee and tea.
I have coffee and tea. Yes, I'm so hopped up right now.
At any second, you're just going to launch off the... Launch off the chair. Jane Lynch ran into the audience and high-fived everyone. It's incredible. Then she wanted to start a business. It was crazy. But I really think that being able to overcome, and even just hearing you say, oh, it was fun the entire time. That's such a valuable lesson for really enjoying the process and not being so goal-oriented.
Yeah, I don't have goals, and I don't recommend them either. I've done a couple of college speeches now where you get the honorary degree and stuff. And the first thing I say is, don't have any ambitions or goals. Just see what rolls in at your feet. Really, and have fun while you're doing it. I love all of it. And, you know, there was a part of me, I think I almost quit the business for 7 minutes. I was hiking Runyon Canyon, and I went, rah, rah, rah. And then by the time I got to the bottom of Runyon Canyon, I was ready to audition again.
Just walked right into an audition.
I walked right
into another audition. I mean, there are a lot of your characters are very authoritative.
Yes.
And what do you attribute that to?
Well, I'm a 6-foot-tall woman, and that's it. And I have terrific posture, as you brought
you
up.
You do. It's incredible. I'm jealous of it.
I think there's an imposing, just physically, I'm imposing. And, I have people who look right at me and say, can I help you, sir? And they're looking right at me because I've got kind of like a masculine energy that you know, if you're not really paying attention, you'll say, can I help you, sir?
And do you ever say, like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
No, I haven't. I usually wait for them to get it. And they go, oh, I'm sorry. And I go, oh, it happens all the time.
Oh, that's so nice. So, but I mean, I think having that, I mean, that's just, you're talking about flexibility. That's not just work flexibility, but that you seem to have a general emotional flexibility with the world.
I remember when I was a kid, though, I walked into the movie theater. And I walked into the ladies' room, and it was one of those huge ladies' rooms, and a mother looked at me, and I think I probably was a little butchier back when I was a kid, too, walked out and looked at the sign make sure. That hurt my feelings.
Well, of course it would.
Yes.
But how do you have such a great attitude with it? Because I feel like we definitely live in an era where there is another person out there who, if they... walked into a restaurant and a guy said, can I help you, sir? Immediately going on social media, I can't believe this restaurant is so disrespectful and how are these people? So how do you not get swept up in...
Being offended?
Yes, being offended.
I stopped being offended a long time ago because I used to get uber offended as a kid. Not just about that stuff, but If I felt slighted, you know, I mean, I had my stuff for sure. But, you know, I think just the maturing emotionally, you let that stuff roll off your back because it's not personal.
Right.
And now if someone were to say something to me like that, it would be laughable.
Well, also because I think social media has trained us to take everything personally.
Yes. Oh, because, that is the worst thing about
because
it.
Because I got a yeah confirmation from the front row.
Yeah,
I appreciate that. I must have made a good point. But the idea that social media teaches you that everything is about you.
Yeah.
Algorithms teach you that everything you want is available to you. And so when things happen, we personalize it and go, I can't believe that. Even if it didn't happen to you, that's the most offensive. You know, we're so addicted to the power rush of being offended and outraged.
And when people support, like, you know, a particular candidate who now got the job, well, you know, saying to people, I'm here for you because you've been kicked around enough. And everybody,
right.
You know, there's this whole thing about we do it for you. It's kind of the whole advertising ethos, too, is about you are important to us. How about that when you call something, they say, please hold the line. Your call is very important to us.
So important that we made that on a recording.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. That's innately not special.
Yeah,
you say
right,
that
exactly.
to everyone. Yeah. But I think not that there aren't things to be outraged about in the world and not that there aren't things that we should genuinely be offended by, but I think it's what do you do with that? I think if you stay in that place of outrage and offense without really trying to understand and work through and create change, then it's like, I think that's the part where we really get sucked in by our egos.
Yeah, I think so too. I think just this whole being easily offended thing, like I think being offended is an ego response, a damaged ego response. I don't know.
And do you have any advice for people out there who might go, Jane, that's a good point. How do I be less offended?
It's not about you. Nothing is about you. It really isn't. It's always about the person who's saying it.
Right.
Always. Even if it's I love you and I think you're beautiful. You know, well, that's nice. But, you know, if you, and the opposite, of course, is if you need if you need the validation of someone telling you how wonderful you are. Either way, it's not good.
Yeah.
You know, either way, it's not good. All of it comes and goes. I hate you today. I love you tomorrow. And just, you know, let it all roll off your back.
That's that is a phenomenal way. And I really do try to, I know I try to do that. My wife would say, like, you probably should try to do that a little bit harder. She's like, why are you reading social media in bed? Oh, it's for work. No, it's not. Stop it.
Stop it.
Yeah. You don't know me. Yes, I do. Okay.
I was reading Twitter before I came out here, and it's just, it could really ruin your day.
It's poisonous.
It's poisonous, and, you know, it's just it's a tough world, and, you know, and you've got people being so thin-skinned about stuff, and, I don't know why I did that.
And then also, do you ever think, like, maybe I don't need to be on social media anymore?
Well, I'm going to stay on social media. Twitter is the only one that I'm going to tweet stuff that, you know, like, professional, like, I'm going to be on this show, or watch this animated movie. I thought it was cool. That kind of stuff that nobody cares about that they go, oh, I'm going to unfollow Jane Lynch because she's boring. But I will stay on it, but I'm not retweeting political stuff anymore.
Yeah.
Just kind of let it all go.
I just think it's important for people I think it's important for voices like yours in the world because I do think you're a great role model. I think you're a great role model for so many reasons, but even just being able to have someone that sort of feels like, hey, yeah, there's fucked up stuff that's going on, but you know, it's not all about you, and you'll be okay. You're going to be okay. I feel like that is a very calming. We need that type of a calming voice in the world.
Yeah, you know, I hear you.
So we talked about TV credits. So let's just get through some film credits really fast here. Wreck-It Ralph, phenomenal.
Thank you.
Phenomenal job.
Wreck-It Ralph 2 coming up.
Wreck-It Ralph 2, yeah.
Yeah, coming up.
Rich Moore.
Yeah, isn't he wonderful?
Rich Moore is a damn genius.
He is, and he's like the most, was the director of both, and also he did Zootopia, I think?
He worked on Zootopia. He was he was one of the guys at Futurama. He worked on The Simpsons.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, when you look at his credits.
That's right. I knew he was on The Simpsons.
You go, oh, wow, all these
like
amazing things.
He's like the nicest, most unassuming, kindest guy in the world, and he's a genius.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we get to 40-year-old Virgin.
Yeah, Virgin.
40-year-old Virgin.
Yep.
And I do know that you almost turned that down.
So I almost did, and I don't know why I almost did. Thank God I didn't. And when I improvised with Steve, who I knew from Second City, Carell, and we came up with a thing where I deflowered him. So I wanted to do that. You know, we improvised that together, so I for sure wanted to do that. Yeah, that was just a moment. That was a blurb, and it would have been a stupid moment in time if I did.
I mean, how do you, because obviously, mm-hmm. you know, agents, managers, people, everyone kind of has their own MO.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when you start to have options, when you start to say, okay, now mm-hmm. people know who I am. I can do these things that I want. You know, what's your sort of guiding force that where you make sure that you're being true to who you are and following the right stuff and not listening to other people?
I listen to me all the time. I don't listen to anybody else. I guess, I'm not doing stuff just to do it anymore, whereas I used to. I mean, you saw that IMDb page. I just loved working. So I don't do that so much anymore.
Right.
If someone invites me for $100 a day to do something that looks like fun, if it's not going to be extremely fun, I probably won't do it.
Right.
But here's the deal. I saw the posters for The Good Fight, and I love... I can't remember her name now.
Which one? Oh, it's Christine Baranski?
Sorry about that. I love Christine Baranski. I think she's an amazing actress. So I watched the first two episodes, and I said to myself, self, I want to do a part on that show. Just a part. I just would love to be on that show. I'd love to work with her. And within 2 days, I got a call for a role, but not working with Christine, unfortunately. But the two women I worked with were fantastic. And so that was a blast. I got to play this really crazy FBI person who's like... crazy like a fox, you know. She acts like a real down home person, but then she goes in with the knife.
Well, it also sounds like you might be magic because you summoned.
Yeah,
you,
I felt that way.
You kind of summoned that.
I felt like I summoned it. Yeah, that was strange.
But I think having so much experience under your belt, and again, I would recommend improv training no matter what field you work in.
I agree.
It really does teach you how to be flexible, but I feel like it also gives you a confidence when you go on to something and everything's going to be okay. So, so when you're working with Meryl Streep. In Julia and Julia,
yeah.
did you feel when you were there? Did you feel like yeah, I belong here? I can do this. Or was
that
there
was
any
a tough sell for me?
that was one
where I had to really talk myself into confidence. Yeah, I was very nervous. Not only was it Meryl Streep, it was Stanley Tucci and Nora Ephron. And,
right.
And I was playing the sister of Meryl Streep, and they're affectionate with each other. They were each other's best friends. So without having met her. Showing up basically the first day and jumping into this, I was nervous. I was very nervous. And I went the day before I started working because Nora wanted to show me how she was playing Julia so that I would be in the same world, you know. And she, all her choices were, well, first of all, Julia Child was a huge woman.
Yeah.
Physically and energetically. And everything she did was, oh, you know, like that. And I guess the sister was just as, you know, animated. So as I was watching her do that, I was like, okay, I think we're in the right world because that's how I practiced it too.
Yeah.
How I kind of worked on it. And it worked out.
I mean, so when you're in a situation like that, is it, I think some of it is just the experience comes out.
Yes.
Once you start doing it, it's just naturally there because you've done it so much. But is there anything you do in particular to get into your comfort space? So you can, because it's easy when you're performing in front of your group, in front of your friends, and when you're in your safe space.
Right, right.
But when you get taken out of that element, what do you do to kind of get yourself into that comfort zone?
I admit I'm scared.
Yeah.
Say, you're scared. It's okay. And I talk to myself like I'm over there. You're scared. It's okay. And you also know how to do this.
Yeah.
So just...
Well, that just sounds like, yeah, I think that's a commentary on just being present.
Yes, exactly.
When you admit that you're scared, you're mm-hmm. being present in the situation.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and that's all that stuff is. And I assume you had an amazing time with Meryl Streep.
I did, yeah. It was really great. And it happens so fast because Nora shoots pretty fast. And so it was like I was walking away going, I did it. Back there somewhere, but it's been done.
But it happened. I don't remember what happened.
Yeah, I have no idea what happened, but I think it was good.
Guess we'll see.
Yeah.
Do your parents watch your stuff?
Yeah. Both my parents have passed away, but my mother. I think the last thing she saw me do was Julie Julia.
Oh wow!
And she I have a great little story about this. My mom came to the premiere of Julie Julia, and it was a big deal. She loves Meryl Streep, and my mother was very Swedish. She was, you know, kind of. A little, I was going to say cold, but she wasn't cold. But she wasn't someone to rave, you know. She wasn't one to go on and on. In fact, she didn't like that. You know, like, I was definitely someone who went on and on, and I could see her as I was a kid, like, going, I don't know if I like this one very much. But so she was about 80 at the time, and we were on the red carpet, and my mom was kind of walking with me. And all of a sudden, we heard the crowd behind the barricades go, and I looked, and it's Meryl Streep.
Oh, wow.
And so I look over, and I'm doing interviews, and I looked over, and I feel this breeze go by me, and it's my mother running.
Your 80-year-old mother running.
80-year-old mother. But I've never seen her run in my life. She's kind of one of those, you know, takes her time. And she just made a beeline for Meryl Streep, and I was like, excuse me. I'm hoofing after her. And she gets up to Meryl Streep, and Meryl Streep does this, because you think you're safe behind, you know,
sure.
There's barricades.
Right.
And she said, I'm Jane Lynch's mother. And she went, oh, that's very nice to meet you.
Oh, that's
very
sweet, though.
So it was very, yeah. So there's a picture of, like, Meryl Streep on the red carpet, and you see my mother in the background like this.
and Meryl Streep not knowing, am I going to have to dive behind a barricade? What's about to happen?
Right,
why
right,
is
right.
this older lady running
right,
at my face?
Exactly.
So was it Glee that kind of, that you feel like pulled all the pieces together? I mean, because Glee mm-hmm. really, to me, and people obviously knew who you were because of Best in Show, mm-hmm. but I think Glee, putting you, like, consistently in people's living rooms every week on a
yeah,
show
oh,
that
yeah,
powerful.
Definitely. That changes everything.
Right.
For sure. How, you know, walking through your life. When you are a familiar character like that, it's different. It was an adjustment. It definitely was. And I'm a pretty social person, but it can be shocking sometimes. I don't know if you experience this, but when you walk in just to get your coffee, and people kind of go like that, that kind of
yeah. Well, I mean. Yeah,
you
I guess that happens sometimes. I don't know. No, the thing that freaks me out is like when you're in an elevator and then you get up to your hotel room and then you check Twitter and someone goes, hey, I just saw you picking your nose in the elevator. And you're like, shit! You know, like everywhere is just, you know,
yeah, yeah.
I get a little paranoid because I go,
yeah,
like, they're watching, they're watching.
Right.
They're
most of the people who are, you know, Glee fans are kids. So it's very hard to tell like a 5-year-old child to buzz off.
Well, also because the show.
So I don't.
The show. It's like actually, I was just about to quote another Ryan Murphy show where it's. Did you watch Betty and Joan feud?
Oh yes.
Oh my god.
Oh my god, that was fantastic.
I think one of the funniest things I've ever seen on a show is Betty Davis getting out of the car, and it's the young reporter there. Miss Davis, do you have any comment on Joan Crawford saying you're old enough to play her mother? What's your name, kid? Stella. Fuck off, Stella. And then she just breezed by.
Yeah.
But also a show like Glee is really about that uncontrolled exuberance.
Yes.
You know, so people who connect with that. But, boy, Ryan Murphy, what a friggin' hit machine.
Unbelievable, yeah. And one after the other, and they're all different, and they're all brilliant.
And did you work, was he pretty hands-on on
the
show?
He was, like, about the first season he was, and then he was off creating everything else, like American Horror Story. So he wasn't around as much, but his hands are on everything. You know, the scripts have to go, but he okayed everything, every costume. Yeah, he was on it. He might not have been physically present. I didn't see him much, but he was definitely a present.
How many seasons of that show?
Five and a half.
Five and a half seasons. And it by the end, was it hard to say goodbye to it, or did you feel like it was time?
No, it felt like it was time. It felt like it was right. I think that, you know, we lost a lot of the air was kind of knocked out of us after Corey Monteith passed away. That was hard. So I think, it went as long as it was supposed to.
Right.
Yeah.
And then did you immediately start working on something else? Or did you take a break?
I didn't. I did a pilot, and it was picked up, and we did 11 episodes in CBS called Angel from Hell that I loved doing, but we were canceled after. Thank you to the four people who watched it. Oh, good. Thank you. Some of you are just clapping because you feel bad for me. That's okay. That's all right. I'll take it.
Oh, poor Jane.
Yeah.
First her mom attacked Meryl Streep and now this. I mean, she can't catch a break.
Exactly. Exactly. But that was, I really enjoyed doing that. And now just doing little stuff here and there. I'll do another television show if the right one comes along. Absolutely. But, you know, for right now,
that's nice. But
like
you feel, you know, pretty solid. Like, whatever happens, happens.
Oh, absolutely.
Are you good with free time?
I am great with free time.
What do you do with free time?
I drink coffee.
Yeah.
I stay home with my dogs. I love my house. But I've been touring a lot. I've been doing a cabaret show mm-hmm. with Kate Flannery, who was married to the
love Kate
of the
Flannery.
Office. Isn't she
yeah.
the best?
She was also in The Lampshades.
Exactly. Oh,
Kate
my
Flannery.
Gosh, yes, the best.
Lampshades, yeah.
Yeah, she's great. And we have a five-piece band, and this guy, Tim Davis, who was a vocal arranger on Glee. And we have, like, a trio, and we've been going all over the country.
That's incredible.
And it's been so much fun. And then next week, I'm doing the St. Louis Symphony all by myself.
Holy cats.
I know.
What are you going to sing?
I'm going to sing songs that I grew up with. Do you remember Alan Sherman? Do you know who he
yeah,
is?
Yeah, of course.
Do you remember Hello Mudda, Hello Fada?
Yeah, of course.
I'm gonna do that one. I'm going to do some Irving Berlin. I'm going to do some Chet Baker, some Cole Porter. Some, God, I can't even...
N.W.A. Think, but, no, I'm kidding.
Exactly.
Just like this throw it in there.
We're
going to do Hello Mother, Hello Father, Fuck the Police, yeah. You know, and then some show tunes.
My Anaconda yeah. Don't, which we actually do in a three-part harmony in our cabaret show.
That's
three,
incredible.
The whitest people you've ever seen.
Incredible. That's incredible.
Anaconda Don't.
I thought you were going to continue with that
I could,
a little bit.
But
you could, but
yeah.
we'll save it for the performance.
We'll save it for
We'll absolutely save it for the performance. We come back. We're going to take a quick break. Our audience members are going to step up. They're going to ask some questions. We're going to hear from you guys at home. If you want to be part of the show, we're at Talking on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Exclusive updates about upcoming guests. And then you can ask questions using the hashtag Talking Hardwick, because we live in a hashtag culture, and nothing is anything unless you can tag it with a hash. No matter who I'm talking to, we want you to be part of the conversation. More with Jane Lynch in just a bit. We'll see you on Talking. My guest is Jane Lynch. Now, it's not about me anymore. It is about you and the audience. So let's have an audience member come on up and ask a question, and I will give a prize.
Oh,
it's you now.
Oh, it's the
Warbler.
Oh, great. Hi. My name's May, and I just wanted to ask you, Jane, what was your favorite Sue Sylvester insult?
I like the one. It's not so much it was a proclamation. She said, from now on, I will no longer be carrying photo ID because people should know who I am.
Excellent. I mean, oh, man. I feel like I have the perfect thing for you. What is your name?
May.
May?
Oh, yeah.
Come on. Signed by Jane Lynch. Listen up, losers, it says. There you go.
Shut up.
Thank you.
Perfect. You're so welcome. I'm so glad.
That's a good one.
I know that is a good one. Let's take a video message.
Ooh.
Hi, Jane. This is Brandon from Overland Park, Kansas. What's the craziest moment you've witnessed from a taping of Hollywood Game Night that maybe didn't make it to air?
First of all, I want to know why Brandon lives in front of a green screen. You could put him into any situation
True.
Right there.
True. I was dry humped by Martin Short.
Of course.
And that ended up, and it was fun. I enjoyed it. It was consensual.
I guess better than being wet humped by Martin Short.
Yes.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Let's see. And that did make it on air, I believe. And we've had a couple of drunk episodes of people we had to cut off, and I'm not going to say who.
Well, I got to tell you, because when I did the show, I mean, again, I'm not a drinker, so it doesn't affect me, but you guys do set, there is a whole bar backstage.
Mm-hmm.
When
your drink is empty, we refill.
Yeah.
We stopped
to
doing that
up.
Last season, though, because it did bite us.
Well, of course, because, you know, your call time is usually a little bit in advance of the show.
Right.
So people are backstage, and they're enjoying, and then before you know it, it's like, you know, 2-3 hours of...
Oh, my gosh, we had some amazing moments that you will never see.
But without naming any names per se, what is one drunken moment that didn't make it to air?
There was a moment where we were in the final round of Celebrity, and one of the celebrities that was chosen to give the clues decided that she wanted to make it a soapbox moment about how hard it is to be a single mother and get good nannies.
Oh, no.
And how it's hard and very serious.
I had no idea Gwyneth Paltrow was on your show. No, I'm kidding. It wasn't her at all.
Girl who was the celebrity, or who was the normie, was looking at going, this is not going to go well.
Did she not win the...
She did not.
She didn't win the thing.
No.
I mean, you do have to remember, when you're on that show, you were there to help someone win.
I know.
$25,000.
That was,
you know,
lost in
that
the
was,
soap
that was completely
moment.
Lost. I mean, Hollywood Game Night is one of those concepts that I know, because there are these legendary, like, groups of celebrities around Hollywood that would have game nights. You know, people's like Neil Patrick Harris is a big game night guy, and people like that. And so people would always talk about, oh, we have to make it a show. So what was it specifically about your version of it that you think just clicked in and worked so beautifully?
Well, one of those notorious game show people in the Hollywood arena is Sean Hayes.
Right, yes.
He has this big house, and he created all of his own games, and you go from room to room. And it's a mix of his celebrity friends and then his friends who are bankers and caterers or whatever they do. So it was the great equalizer. And so he was smart enough to say, hey, let's put that on television. So Sean is the creator of our show. So I think that's what makes it special, is that we create all of our own games. And what you have are celebrities instead of, like, I love this kind of talk show.
Right.
Where we get to have a conversation.
Yeah.
But, you know, kind of the contrived late night talk show where you're like, sitting on the couch and you say, well, tell me about what happened to the car wash or whatever. And I tell a moderately, vaguely lukewarm, funny story. The Hollywood Game Night is all about the celebrities just being themselves and having fun.
Yeah.
So I think as a celebrity, you'd much rather do Game Night.
I had so much fun doing your show.
Great.
And I got to meet Mike Coulter, who was Luke Cage. And
yeah,
he
right.
was great.
Yeah.
And the whole experience, just top to bottom, was so much
Wasn't
fun.
Wasn't it fun? And what happens is that these are people, and this is why I love throwing parties, too. You'll have like three celebrities on a couch and Normie, and who have never met each other before, and they're pals and teammates and having a great time by the end. That makes me so happy when I give a party and I see people who otherwise wouldn't have known each other and they're having a great time together.
That's I mean, that's exactly what it feels like. But it really just feels like we're all hanging out.
Yeah.
And by the way, this happens to be filmed and we're doing this thing and someone might win money by the end.
Yeah.
I'm just going to take a couple questions from social media here. One, Andrew Rose on Instagram. What is the most surreal moment you've had in show business?
Surreal moment.
I guess having your mom run full bore at Meryl Streep is kind of weird.
At Meryl Streep. Surreal. Oh, that's such a good question. You know, there is minimal bad behavior in my history. Is it yours too?
Yes.
You know, but every once in a while, you know, especially when I was younger doing like guest spots, bad behavior, people putting up with just really bad behavior on the part of, you know, a star.
Right.
Always just blew my mind.
Yeah, but I think it's also a good learning experience when you see that and you go, oh, yeah, maybe don't do that.
Yeah, maybe keep your feet on the ground before that happens.
Yeah, because sometimes, you know, well, you talked about how the commercial audition process can ruin a lot of people.
Yes.
Like, it can make, but I think people kind of come out with whatever baggage they went in with.
I agree.
And I think, you know, sometimes people come into this business, they go, well, I'm successful, that's going to fix me. And then, you know, when you get that, then you're like, shit, I'm not fixed.
Yeah,
you know?
I know, yeah.
So I think people really do, you know, I think your personality is just, that's who you are. That's who you were coming in, and that's who you are, you know.
I'm going out.
Coming through the process. Coming through the process on the other side. But I do think that that it is important to remember that it's silly that we get to do this stuff for a living.
I know, it is. It's like playing house for a living.
It really is.
Yeah. Oh, you're going to play my daughter. Oh, and you're going to be my husband. This is so much fun.
I'm not coming out of my trailer. Yeah. God damn it. Come on. Let's take another question from the audience. What is your name?
Kim.
What's your question?
All the way from Calgary.
What?
Calgary,
just
bro?
To come see you.
You drove from Calgary?
I did.
By yourself?
Well, with my daughter and my grandson who are back at the hotel.
Oh, they're back at the hotel.
That's
He's
amazing.
10. He couldn't come in.
He couldn't come in.
That is
so
a
sorry.
Long drive.
It is.
Well,
I'm
thank
glad
you for coming.
Yes. Well,
what is your question?
My question is...
I'm sorry, that's all the time we have.
Sorry.
Thank you so much.
Good night, everybody.
For driving in from Calgary. I'm just kidding.
We hearing all about your comedic and singing, and I love Criminal Minds.
Oh,
I love your character on Criminal Minds. It was so crazy this year.
Yeah.
What is it like to play such an emotionally taxing role?
Well, you know, I did, like I always do, I do my research, and I get very precise about it, and I play Matthew Gubler, the actor, he plays Reed. I play his mother, Dana Reed. And I've been institutionalized. I have, what am I, bipolar and schizophrenic and early onset Alzheimer's now. And so, you know, this is a woman who just is trying to keep things organized in her head. She has always has like a flurry of things going on, and the best she can do is just be very still.
You're excellent at it.
Oh, well, thank you. But that was it continues to be wonderful. I hope I go back next season.
And then I understand, I mean, I can understand that playing a role like that is also... There's a tremendous amount of social responsibility, I would imagine, to portray this character.
Yeah, you don't
want
to do something, you know, you really want to know what you're doing. And
right.
The writers are so smart, they're not just kind of cavalierly throwing off a mental disease. They know what it is. And they gave me certain challenges as an actor because of this particular disorder. And So yeah, it was my job to figure out what that was.
It's great.
Kim, I feel like I want to give you something extra special because I'm gonna let you pick here what you want. I mean, you could have this.
Well, it's got a whistle too.
This is a script from Best in Show, which is really just an empty because there's no
we
script, so it's just a cover page here. You could have this if you wanted
Rhapsody
it.
And blue.
And then a dodgeball if you wanted a dodgeball. Is there anything that you drove all the way? You should get to pick.
I think I'll do the jacket.
You're gonna do the sweatsuit. Yes. Yeah. Signed by Jane on the front right there.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you to make the drive. Let's take a video message from a fan. Take a look.
Hi, I'm Cliff from San Jose, California. My question is, if you could travel back in time and talk to your 15-year-old self, what words of wisdom would you give her?
Oh, that's so great. I actually have thought about this, and I wrote a memoir, and that was actually the first line was, what would I say to my 18-year-old self? But let me go back to 15-year-old self. The first thing I would say is, do not worry. Stop worrying about everything's going to turn out fine. You're going to be a big star, have Emmys, and make a lot of money. No, I wouldn't say that.
But it'd be implied.
It would be implied, but it would be have faith in your life. And I would say that to anybody. And instead of reaching out for things, which I always did, I was like, I didn't want the parade to pass me by.
Sure.
I would say, just relax. The parade's coming to you. And it comes to everybody.
But trying to remember that in the moment, because, you know, it can be so difficult sometimes when you feel overwhelmed, and then the world can be overwhelming, and then you have your self-doubt and your insecurities, the royal you.
It's just really, it's a particularly difficult time when you're 15 because of the hormones and the craziness, and you're not a kid, and you're not an adult yet, and, I would just say, just don't worry. And I think I would have listened. I really think I would have listened. All I wanted someone to do was to tell me, don't worry.
Yeah.
Because everybody's telling you, oh, you better do this, you better do that.
Well, and now again, you know, just because we know everything that's going on at all times in the world, and most of what we see is negative because, you know, the people respond. I mean, there is a lot of negative stuff in the world. There's also positive things.
I know. Agreed. And we don't hear about the positives.
No, because negativity and fear drives traffic.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
So it's more profitable to fearmonger to get people upset because then you're going to go to the website. It's all clickbait. You know, we're in the sort of fear
clickbait
culture. We
love to feel outraged. I know when I'm on my Twitter feed, I go to it unconsciously to be outraged about something.
Yeah.
Oh, and I watched some things today that just blew. Oh, and I had to put my phone away and go, there's some great stuff going on out there, too.
You really do. Yeah, I think it is important to find nuggets of things in real life that are calming and are peaceful and a little bit of a positive safe space from the rest of it. Let's see. Jenny Who, 34. What is your favorite and least favorite role and why? You don't have to say least favorite because that's kind of negative. You can if you want. But let's just say what's your favorite role so far?
Well, I don't have a least favorite. I can't think of something that I disliked. But I love doing Constance Carmel on Party Down, which was a show we did on
it's a great
Stars
show. Adam
Network.
Scott.
Adam Scott, Lizzie Kaplan, Ken Marino, Ryan Hansen.
It's an incredible group of comedy people.
Yeah, really great. Martin Starr. And we were basically left to our... We were played caterers who would go... Every episode was a different party. And we all were wannabes in some... Like, I was a kind of an ex-actress who wanted to, you know, have a revival. Some people wanted to be actors. Some people wanted to be screenwriters. You know, one of them wanted to run his own catering company. So it was people... in that place of, like, I wish I was somewhere else except right here. And we were left alone by Starz Network. We didn't get any notes. And the production team and the creators of Veronica Mars were our writers. And
uh-huh.
Just John Embaum and Rob Thomas and Dan.
Oh, Edwards. Yeah, Rob, yeah.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, so we had a blast.
And was it, how many episodes of that show did you
do? We did 10 episodes of the first season, and then I left to do Glee. And Megan Mullally came in and joined the group in the second season is fantastic, too. So you can see that, I think, on iTunes. It's really good.
It's on iTunes. Yeah, Party Down's great if you guys haven't seen it yet. Before we go to break, the extended version of this chat will be available as a podcast on Nerdist. Also go to amc.com/chalking. You're going to get your bonus clips. You're going to have exclusive content, links to the podcast for every one of the episodes. More with Jane Lynch in just a few moments. We'll see you. Welcome back. I'm back with the amazing and delightful Jane Lynch. Let's give some more love to the studio audience. Come on up and ask a question.
Hi. What's your name?
Erica Howe.
What is your question for Jane, Erica?
Before your acting career really kind of took off, we all know that, like, actors all had to go through all these, like, odd jobs. What was your strangest one that you've done?
I pumped gas at Sears.
What?
Yeah, we used to have a gas island at our Sears in Calumet City, Illinois, which is a town next to my town. And I wasn't allowed to pump the... I was allowed to do the windshields, but I would sneak and pump the gas.
What?
You're a rule breaker,
yeah,
Jane Lynch.
Yeah, I was a rebel even back then. I also took... I was at a fitting room at Sears. I kind of worked in many different departments, and I was the person who said, how many? And gave you your thing.
Gave you the card, how many things you have.
You want any of it? Nope. Okay, then I have to hang it back up.
Excellent. What is... did you have another question?
You don't have to.
It just looked like maybe you were about to...
I think she was about to thank me.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I wonder if... I wonder what I can give to you... What would be good? Would you like this Best in Show script book? Okay,
yeah,
here
you go.
This is for you, Erica. Thank you. Fantastic. Think fast. Come on. Why would you not? And now I'm out because you caught it. Shit! No good at dodgeball. Good reflexes, by the way.
Yeah, really?
All right, let's check it. Let's ask a couple more questions. This is from JLou111 on Instagram. What influence do you think your role on The L Word had on women in general and gay women?
I don't know about my character so much, but I'll get to that. I'll go general first. I think The L Word was kind of like All in the Family was for... not being so precious about television.
Right.
And then we kind of backtracked.
Okay.
You know, if you watch All in the Family now, you go, oh, my God, that was revolutionary. But you would think that shows would continue to be that good and that brilliant.
Right.
Well, here you had a group of lesbians kind of who loved each other as friends. It wasn't all about coming out. And, you know, it was kind of like a soap opera, and then it was about relationship drama and stuff. But it normalized, you know, that, you know, lesbians are people like everybody else. They have their dramas. They have their betrayals. They have their straight friends and their gay friends. And
right.
I think it was a great step forward, and we haven't had anything like it since. That was 2006.
Wow. I mean, is it surprising to you that in 2017 that we still have to have conversations with people like, yeah, it's not... strange.
Yeah.
It's normal.
Yeah.
It's just humans. What is the fucking problem?
I know. I think it's that need to be outraged.
Yeah.
We're all protecting our little territory of what we think is right.
Right.
And so, you know, as long as we're like that, this is going to happen. But it seems like we make these huge strides forward, and then we fall back a little bit, only to take off.
I hope that's the case. All right. This is from Chris Everett Dar on Twitter. How was it singing with Olivia Newton-John surrounded by sexy guys in spandex? Oh.
I barely noticed the guys because I kept looking into the baby blues of Olivia Newton-John.
Perfect, perfect, yeah.
She's, you know, I had a huge crush on her when I was
As did
a kid. I? Yep.
Yeah.
And she was just, remember I Honestly Love You, that song?
Yes.
Oh, that used to just break my heart, and
there's
I loved her.
I'm legitimately... unironically, we'll go through and just watch all the Olivia Newton-John videos.
Because really?
Yes. The two, when I first sort of had a sense of what being attracted to the opposite sex was, it was Carrie Fisher as Princess Leia.
Okay.
And then Olivia Newton-John mm-hmm. as Sandy in Grease.
Grease, yeah.
Those two things. And when she puts on the spandex at the end, I was like,
yeah.
What's happening to me?
It confirmed just, my lesbianism.
It totally confirmed.
Yeah, that's when I went, oh, I'm screwed. I'm screwed.
You watch these old music videos of her, and it was like, oh, she's, you know, she was Taylor Swift before Taylor Swift.
Yes.
She was just like this perfect being.
Yeah, she continues to be a perfect being. I really enjoyed doing that with her, and we remade the physical video, which she told me that she was kind of, She didn't like to do sexy things when she was younger. She was very modest, and they put her in that spandex outfit, and she was so afraid of it. It was such a risk for her to do that. And you look at it now, it looks so lame.
Yeah, it's just not that crazy.
Yeah,
it's not,
no,
that,
it's not crazy
that crazy at all.
Yeah.
Okay, this is from Joey M. Avina on Twitter. What performance on Glee was your favorite?
Let's see. Oh, my God, there were so many. I thought the Thriller was an amazing thing when they did Thriller on the football field. Vogue. I'd vote, and not just because I starred in it, but because it was, we took the original Vogue video and we copied it almost frame for frame.
Right.
And as we were shooting it, they would have the video up on this monitor and what we were doing on this monitor, and they were matching the lighting. You know, it was black and white. And we used a lot of the same props that they used in the original video because it was at the Paramount prop house. When we shot on Paramount.
Oh, wow. That's
so that
really cool.
Pretty amazing. So that was really a fun thing to do, and it took us one whole day. It looks like it, you know, could take a week to do.
But you guys banged it out in
yeah,
one day.
Yeah, we banged it out one day. Mm-hmm.
So as we're wrapping this up, and I feel like there's been a lot of, like, nice, juicy wisdom nuggets throughout this conversation with you, but is there some thing that you want to leave the audience with wisdom-wise? Like, what's something that you live by, or something maybe a relative told you at some point, or something you keep in your head? What's one nugget that you can leave everyone with?
Stay as firmly in the now as you can, in the present, because there's nothing else. There's really, all you have are memories and projections into the future. But your head is going to criticize you all the time, and I'm learning to just let that be quiet and just stay, see what's really juicy about right now. And it's there. It's any time of the day. It's the best place to be is now.
And I love that you say, like, that, you know, your head's going to criticize you. I think it's fun to pretend like your life is the Muppet Show and the voice in your head is Statler and Waldorf
right.
Why do we always come here? You know.
Yeah, I think that's perfect.
And you keep doing the fucking Muppet Show. You
exactly.
keep doing the Muppet Show. They don't stop doing the Muppet Show because those guys are criticizing
them. Right, exactly.
They just kind of go, okay,
whatever.
Just put them up there.
Mm-hmm.
So, so just learn to not internalize your own personal Statler and Waldorf.
Exactly, that's perfect.
But I cannot thank you so much for being here.
Chris,
I cannot thank you enough for being here, Jane Lynch. You were delightful, and I knew you'd be an amazing guest.
Well,
and
thank
I really
you.
Appreciate
I'm
it.
So glad you reached out.
Thank you for coming here. Twitter. Be sure to check out Hollywood Game Night, which is on NBC, a fine network. And I think my episode, I don't know by the time if this airs, if mine will have been on or not, but it doesn't matter. Watch all Hollywood Game Night.
The episode starts the 22nd.
It starts 22nd. Great. And always check in with us at Talking on Facebook. Jane is at Jane Marie Lynch on Twitter. And hopefully we'll see you soon. We want you to be a part of the show, so make sure and stay involved. Let us know if there's anything you want to see, questions you have for people coming up. I'm Chris Hardwick at Hardwick on the tweets and the Instagrams. Please don't text and drive. I'm going to keep saying this until you stop doing it. And have an amazing night. We'll see you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.